It's difficult for those of us who have not served in the military to understand what it's like. It can also be difficult for veterans to tell their stories. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Telling Des Moines is a performance that gives veterans a chance to tell their stories and gives audiences a chance to understand what their experiences have been like. This hour, I'll talk with Jonathan Way. He's the founder of the Telling Project. He's produced performances like this in 9 different states over the past 4 years. I'll also talk with the director of this performance and 2 of the individuals who will be telling their stories. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, the performance Telling Des Moines premieres on stage in Ankeny, with additional shows tomorrow and Saturday. The show features 7 Iowa veterans who tell their stories. The first act focuses on when they joined the military, the second act on their military service, and the final act on coming home. Different versions of Telling, always including local veterans, have been performed in 9 different states around the country over the last 4 years. Jonathan Way is the creator of the Telling Project. He's based in Austin, Texas, but he'll be in Iowa for the performances. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Charity. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And take me back to the origin of this idea for the Telling Project. What gave you this idea?
Well, you know, it's a fairly simple notion. What we were encountering, the first project that we did was in Eugene, Oregon, working with veterans at the University of Oregon. And what they were encountering, I was their advisor. I am not myself a veteran. What we were encountering was a fairly prolific sense of isolation, at least as regarded their experience in the military, oftentimes as regarded them in general as military veterans. It wasn't necessarily an acrimonious isolation. It was just there was a politeness that surrounded their experience that seemed to be too uncomfortable with talking about it, being unable to approach it. And what we wanted to do was create a situation where conversations could begin. And we felt like one of the ways to do that would be to give them the opportunity to tell their stories, but not necessarily extemporaneously. There are certain liabilities, I think, with extemporaneous storytelling, especially as regards many of the stories that these folks have, that they're, they run into situations where they're potentially uncomfortable, where they will potentially say things they don't want to say or leave things out that they wish that they had left in. And we thought that using a theatrical approach would allow them to both tell their stories and also to work through to making their stories what they wanted them to be.
So when you start a new production, like Telling Des Moines, where do you start? How do you find veterans?
Well, with Des Moines, we basically were invited to come into the community by DMAC, the community college. They were just, they were looking for some kind of a program that was going to, again, similar to the situation in Eugene, start some conversations across the civilian-military divide. And the people that we were working with at DMAC had connections to certain military organizations. So what we had to do with them is, we basically started working with their connections in the military community and the veteran military community, and just put out a general call for interviews. That's the way it happened in Des Moines. We've been invited into communities by veterans organizations themselves directly, and we've been invited into communities by arts organizations. And in each situation, making contact with the vets community, that's certainly a part of the initial stages. As we grow and as our reputation expands, one of the things that you learn about the veterans community is that it works largely word of mouth. And so a lot of people have heard of us at this point, so we have a little bit less of a challenge in terms of gaining access to folks who are interested in participating.
So once you've identified veterans, you need to talk to them. What's the interview process like?
The interview process is a fairly wide open one. What we want to make sure people know going into it is that they're welcome to say anything that they want to say. They're welcome to talk about anything they want to talk about in relationship to their military experience. They're also welcome to leave anything out that they don't feel comfortable talking about. And that being said, we also assure them that whatever happens in the interview, ultimately what comes out in the storytelling itself and the performance, they're going to have any number of different opportunities along that process to say yes, no, yes, no, to continue editing, to continue revising, refining, enhancing, doing whatever they need to do to make that story right with them. So what we try to do with the interview is create a space in which they are in control entirely, and they can kind of let their story come as it comes. And many people, a lot of these folks, the stories are really easy. They're right there. They may have told them many times before. They may never, they may not have any kinds of qualms about it. And for some folks, it's the first time they talked about some stuff. And it can be a very intense process. We've had interviews that have gone 10 hours. We interviewed one man who is still in the military. He was in it at the time we interviewed him for 17 years. And he just was a storyteller and really, had a lot to say, had a great number of very interesting experiences and reflections. We've also had interviews that are 45 minutes. It really, they're very idiosyncratic. But essentially, the interview structure follows the exact same structure as you described at the beginning of the show, with of the play itself. So there, it's three essential sections that we will try and make sure are covered in each interview, from enlistment and boot basic training, then into deployments, and then reflections on the return to civilian life.
How do you decide which veterans will be included in a performance?
They decide. It's self-selecting. So we basically will, anyone who wants to perform gets to perform. And usually out of a pool of interviewees, I would say it's 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 people who actually decide that that's something that they want to take that next step. The interview itself is oftentimes a very powerful and very meaningful experience for the people who go through it, and that's enough. And that's all they need to do. That's all they feel compelled to do. And then there are some people who are just so nervous about the prospect of getting on stage or so disinterested in it that that's not something that's compelling for them. So we basically have a group of people who are sufficiently curious and sufficiently, piqued by the notion of both learning how to perform and then actually performing their own stories. And some people are there because they get put up to it by their friends, but that's also a part of the it's a kind of, it creates a little community among the people who actually decide to do that.
Once the people who have decided they want to participate have made their decision, you mentioned sometimes a 10-hour interview. How do you take that story and create a script that can be performed along with these other actors, these other veterans, and put it into a show that's less than 2 hours long?
It's really, that's the majority of the work that I do. I help with production on all phases as a consultant, but scripting is what I do. That's my main role. And it's not easy. It's endlessly fascinating work. You have to make some very difficult decisions. But essentially what I do is I transcribe the interviews myself all by hand, and I try to conduct as many of the interviews as I can because I want it to be a contiguous process from initial introduction to an individual through, reviewing what they've talked about and initially hearing what they've talked about and then reviewing it and then choosing from that what I think is most essentially important to them. And it's a tremendously flawed process, and that's, again, part of it is that I will put this script together, I'll hand it over to them, but I'll always hand it over to them with the very strong condition that these are my suggestions. This is what I saw, but this is not necessarily what they want to talk about, and that they have absolute license to make those changes once they've started working with the script, once they started actually working on the performance. But it's painstaking. Writing a script from interview through transcription is hundreds of hours. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of attention, but it's it's endlessly fascinating, rewarding, moving, and very powerful work. And I would not trade it for anything in the world.
You mentioned that for the veterans that you interview, sometimes the interview alone can be an incredibly powerful experience. What do you think the experience of getting up on stage and telling your story as a veteran, what does that do for the people who participate?
I think it's entirely individual. You know, one of the things that we, the Telling Project as an organization, emphasizes when we start working with these folks is that we're not therapists, we're artists. And what we're doing is working to create this performance with them. And what it does for them individually is something that is going to be entirely, you know, it's going to come out of their experience of it. I think that there are some people who really, you know, they didn't necessarily come away from it feeling like, you know, that was a great experience for me personally. Nobody that I've worked with has been regretful of doing it or remorseful in any way. I think that they've all felt strongly that it was important work that they were doing and that it was compelling and that, you know, what was gotten out of it, whether it was by them or by the audience, was valuable. But then I think that on the other hand, there have been people who have walked away from the experience. There's a woman who we worked with in Washington, D.C. last May, and she spoke for the first time of some trauma that happened to her in the military. And it was the first time that she ever spoken of it outside of the therapist's office. And since then, she has gone on to, you know, she's pursuing her degree in social work, and she's spoken about these experiences openly in other contexts as well, and become something of an advocate for folks who have gone through these kinds of experiences. And this is, you know, this is the other end of the spectrum, is that some people come away with this with a tremendous personal benefit, emotional, psychological, however you wish to phrase that. You know, again, my emphasis in all of this, and I think that this is potentially, you know, what is valuable about it across a broad spectrum of experience, of military experience, my emphasis is as an artist. And so what I can do with that perspective is that I can simply look at whatever is being spoken about, whoever is speaking, and they are just them. And that's it. There's not necessarily a therapeutic. There's not necessarily, you know, there certainly isn't any kind of a political or moral or ethical or judgmental framework in which I'm viewing this. What I'm doing is I'm looking at stories and individuals, and that's all. And as a result, you know, you get this tremendous breadth of experience, both being portrayed on the stage through these performances, but also a tremendous breadth of experience that each of the individuals goes through in the process of making one of these performances.
Jonathan Way, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Charity.
Jonathan Way is the founder of The Telling Project. Telling Des Moines will be performed 3 times, this morning at 11:15, tomorrow at 7 p.m., and again Saturday evening at 7. The performances will be at the Des Moines Area Community College campus in Ankeny. You can find more information on our Facebook page or at tellingdesmoines.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Telling Des Moines, a performance featuring Iowa veterans telling their own stories. Jennifer Fawcett is the director of Telling Des Moines. She teaches theater, literature, and humanities at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids and Cornell College in Mount Vernon. She also directed Telling Iowa City a year ago. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer, once the veterans are selected for the show, once they've written their stories, that's where you come in. Describe your role.
Well, actually, I did some of the interviews for both projects. So I was there from the beginning. And what we did was we videotape an interview, and those interviews can go anywhere from 1 hour to 4, sometimes longer. You know, we just keep putting the tapes in. And then we transcribe the interview, and it's really great to kind of meet people in that first time when they come in the room, and they all say, "Oh, I don't really have much to say." And then, you know, 4 hours later, they realize that they do actually have a lot to say, and that it's important. And then, before we get the script, we start working with the cast. Anybody who does the interview is invited to what we call the second phase of the project, which is the performance. And those who decide that they want to go on with that, we start meeting a month or so before they get the script to do theater games and just get to know each other a little bit, get comfortable.
Well, you said that many of the people that you interview say, oh, I don't really have much to say. So that makes me think that not only do they think no one's interested in their story, but they're probably a little nervous about telling it. And then you want them to tell their story on stage.
Yes.
So that seems like a big leap for a lot of people.
It is a big leap. And it's a profound leap, I think, and incredibly powerful to be a part of. I mean, I'm coming at it from a theater background, not from a military background. And, you know, they come into this project, I think, going, I don't know what this is, but okay. We play these games and, you know, try to get them comfortable being on stage. And then they get the script and they read their stories again and they hear each other's stories. And that's a very, very moving evening. And then we start working on those stories. And so they have to start telling those stories over and over and over again. And they change. Memories come back. We shape the story to make sure that people are saying what they want to say. And of course, we're trying to weave them all together into some kind of a coherent narrative. And then we prepare them to be on stage in front of an audience, which is what we're doing right now. So there's technical things that you want to talk about, like speak loud enough and all that sort of thing. But it's also about getting people to tell these stories that are sometimes messy. Just, you know, memory can be messy, right? Mm-hmm. So making sure that we can bring an audience through a memory, they can be very emotional. So making sure that they can make it through, that's why we practice over and over and over again.
Is there a fine line there? Because if they're telling something that is emotional, you want that emotion to be conveyed to the audience, although you don't want someone to have the experience of breaking down on stage. How do you walk that line between helping them be able to tell the story without breaking down themselves, but also not making it automatic and not making it sanitized?
You know, I don't know that it could get sanitized. We do it just through repetition. But I will say that when, you know, we can rehearse something in you know, private multiple times, and then they stand in front of an audience and all of a sudden it goes to a whole new level. I just tell them that whatever happens on stage is okay. They are there as a unit. That they are, you know, and that's something that's very familiar to them. And one of the reasons why we start working earlier, they have formed a really cohesive bond to each other. So you have each other's backs. That's what I, you know, tell them. And you can turn to each other for help if you need help. And it's incredibly powerful to watch when that does happen. And if the emotions come, then they come. And that's part of it. One of our cast members, he was a survivor of Pearl Harbor. So he's in his 90s. And he is going to be standing on stage telling his story. And he has told this story a number of times. And we were working on it just the other day, and it got him. You know, all these years later, and he's told it however many times, and it still got him. So there's something very, very raw about the stories that doesn't seem to go away. And I think that's what's so important for the audience to get to hear and to get to witness.
Having been through this experience once before yourself as the director of Telling Iowa City last year, was there a moment that made you think, yes, I want to do this again. I want to be a part of this.
There was. I think it was at the end of the first show. And we'd gone through the ups and downs of the process. And we'd gone through the nerves. And the audience had come and they listened. They listened for an hour and 40 minutes to people tell their stories. And then they leapt to their feet and they applauded. And I think that's when it really, I mean, I knew all along, but I think that's when it hit me in a different way. Like, this is important. This is very necessary. And then also watching what happened with the cast last year as they got to experience that. We did 6 shows in total, as well as other smaller appearances, and how they changed. I feel like it has allowed them to open up in a way that may mean that they never go on stage again, but will help them in their lives in some way. I think that's something that's very unique that theater can do. They have been heard. They have been listened to. And that is what this project is about.
Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Fawcett is the director of Telling Des Moines. Joy Helt is one of the storytellers in Telling Des Moines, but she is not a veteran. She's a military sister, spouse, and mom, something she's been honored for, even with the Molly Pitcher Award for support of the 194th Field Artillery Regiment's 2007-2008 deployment to Kosovo. She lives in Madrid. Hello, Joy.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And you actually met your husband through your brother. So you met him because of the military, right?
Yes. Yes.
What was he involved in when you met?
Well, it's interesting. My older brother and my husband were working together at a maintenance facility on Camp Dodge at the time. And they became friends. And my older brother said, "Hey, I'm bringing my friend by." And the rest is history.
And your brother was involved in the National Guard at that time. Do you have other military connections in your family?
Not currently, other than my son is slotted to leave for the Air Force in February.
Tell me a little bit about some of the comings and goings that you and your husband have been through over the years.
Of course, there's always the annual training every year, which is 2 weeks, and there's always the weekend every month. But in 2007 to 2008, he deployed to Kosovo. And I initially went into it with thoughts of, oh, it's Europe. Bombs aren't dropping. Okay, I can do this. Not a big deal. And he deployed in July. And by August, we had unexpectedly buried my dad. And it was a little more difficult than I initially expected.
How long was he gone during that deployment?
He was gone for a year, came back injured. He had had a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot to the lungs. So it's, you know, serious, life-threatening situation. Yeah, it was quite a healing process, not just physically, but mentally, emotionally, spiritually, in every way for the whole family.
How old were your children when he was deployed?
Our oldest was 14, and our youngest was 6 or 7, about first grade.
While your husband was gone, what kind of contact were you able to have with him?
Pretty much we would instant message back and forth to each other, and we invested in webcams before he left. So every single day that we could, and we tried to do it every day, you really rearrange your whole schedule so that you can be available for that phone call. So that was a lot of what we did through the webcam.
And as you mentioned, this was a peacetime deployment. When he was away, did you worry about his safety?
No, simply because I was at the time naive enough, because later I learned after he deployed that Kosovo was still considered a combat zone. Some of the pictures since that he has shared with me, I just couldn't take my eyes off of them. I just thought, how could people do these things? And somewhere along the line, it dawned on me, oh, wait a minute. He had to be there to take those pictures. So,
like what? What did you see?
There were tires on fire rolling towards the photographer, and that photographer would have been my husband. Also, it has now been released, but it wasn't released at the time. He would go on patrols with some of the other guys, although that was not his role at the time, but he wanted to be part of the rest of them and go out on patrols with them. And they uncovered some mass graves.
It sounds to me like there were lots of things that he experienced when he was deployed that he didn't tell you about in those daily webcam conversations.
Yeah, yep. And, you know, the spouse and the family kind of do the same thing, simply because you don't want the other person to worry. And when my husband deployed and we said goodbye, my focus to him was focus on the mission. because I know when soldiers get distracted, that's when someone gets injured, that's when someone gets hurt or killed. And so I didn't want him worrying about things at home. And I know there are things that he didn't tell me either for the same reason.
How did that affect your relationship when he got back?
Yes, it did affect it, but it didn't so much. What affected our relationship was how wounded he was when he came back. And when I say wounded, so many people think physically, loss of a limb, something like that. And yes, he was physically wounded, and yes, it was life-threatening. However, soldiers that come back, even if it is a mission that doesn't look like it's going to be life-threatening, yeah, there were times that it was life-threatening. And, yeah, he came home with post-traumatic stress. And trying to manage that on his own is what affected our relationship. And not just mine and his, but his and the whole family. So it's not easy. And I used to think that when a soldier comes home, even as a military spouse, I was naive before I went through it because I used to think, oh, the soldier's home, everything's fine, we don't need to worry anymore. And I have since learned that that is the time that we really need to rally around each other as military family and support each other through that first year. Yeah, especially that year. And it seems to be when soldiers get to that one-year anniversary and they're home, a lot of them start, I don't know, letting the emotions come, or I don't know how to describe it, but that seems to be the point where things kind of start happening. And that's kind of what happened for us. We were physically separated for a little while, which was very, very hard. And I had tried to get intervention through different avenues, but nothing seemed to really come to fruition until we actually had a crisis. And then the intervention came. It came very quickly. So then we were able to reunite, and we're back together as a family doing great. But, yeah, post-traumatic stress is a daily management. It's never truly just gone.
Can you tell me what the crisis was?
We were having an argument, and he slapped me. So I went to the police and filed a report, and as I said, he was out of the house for a while. So not a fun thing to happen.
You've been through all of this, and now your son has joined the Air Force.
Yep.
How do you feel about that?
You know, my first reaction, no, I don't want that. Although I didn't say that to him. But then, like I said, he went and worked on his general education courses. And then a year later, he still had that desire, still just really felt that that was where he was supposed to go. And so my husband and I sat down and had a private conversation. And we both came to the same conclusion that we need to support him. This, you know, he's coming to us again. This is not something he's going to let go. And so we, of course, then told our son, we will support your decision. And my husband went with him to talk to the Air Force recruiter. And, so he's raised his hand and sworn in and is slotted to leave in February.
What made you decide you wanted to tell your story in this performance?
Having the experience that I had when he came home several times, I have had someone thank my husband for his service and say nothing to me and the kids who were with him at the time. And I tell about one incident. We were in a restaurant, and a woman just about tripped over me to get to my husband. And I don't remember why he was still in uniform from work that day, but for some reason he was still in his ACUs. And We were at a restaurant. She, like I said, she about tripped over me to get to him, enthusiastically shake his hand and say, oh, thank you for your service. And I thought, am I invisible? And, of course, you know, I thought, oh, let it go, let it go, let it go. And I was just at that point to where I decided, no, I'm not going to let it go. So I walked over to her table and said, ma'am, yes. I said, I hope you understand that when a soldier serves, the family serves as well. So that is really my message and the reason that I'm sharing my story, because I really believe that more attention should be paid to how deployment and post-traumatic stress affects the family.
Joy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Joy Helt is one of the storytellers who will be on stage for Telling Des Moines with performances today, tomorrow night at 7, and Saturday night at 7 on the DMAC campus in Ankeny. In a moment, we'll hear from veteran Steve Hyde. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Veterans Day is on Sunday, and this hour we're talking about some of the ways that Iowa veterans are being remembered this year. We're talking about a performance called Telling Des Moines. The performance features Iowa veterans telling their stories about what it was really like to serve in the military. Steve Hyde is one of the veterans who will be sharing his story. He served first in the Army and then in the Army National Guard, his career running from 1965 to 2007. He served with the 4th Infantry Division in Vietnam as a helicopter crew chief and door gunner. He's also a recipient of the Purple Heart, and he lives in Des Moines. Steve, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, you're very welcome. Glad to be here.
The performance has three different acts, and in the first part, we find out how the veterans who are in the performance got involved in the military. Why did you sign up?
I was at a stage in my life, I was, you know, 18 years old, fresh out of high school, and growing up in Cedar Falls, just a few blocks from the university, going to college was not the adventure that it was for a lot of the other kids I went to school with. So I just looked for something different. I come from a family of veterans, so my family has a military history, and starting in World War II, actually going all the way back to the Civil War. So it just seemed like the thing to do, but when it came time to make the decision, I wound up in the Waterloo Post Office flipping a coin.
You didn't decide until you got to the post office?
Yeah, I was going to go down there and just check it out. The Navy and the Air Force were on the second floor. I did not want to walk up those stairs. So I looked to the left and saw the Marine Corps, looked to the right and saw the Army, and I realized I had a decision to make. So I made the best decision I could. I decided to flip a coin, and it came up Army. So the rest is history, as they say.
You served in Vietnam as a helicopter crew chief and a door gunner. What was your experience like there?
It was an entirely different environment, of course, than I'd ever been in. You know, I grew up in and around Iowa farms, and my dad worked in a factory and kind of, you know, middle-class lifestyle. And all of a sudden, I find myself in this faraway place of strange sights and smells and doing a job I never, ever thought I would do. It had its light sides, bright sides. Then it had its extremely terrifying side as well. So,
what exactly did you do on the helicopter?
Well, as the crew chief, I was actually a helicopter mechanic, and so when the aircraft was on the ground, it was my job to service it, make sure it had the oils and fuels, and that everything was inspected and working properly, and make minor repairs. But then when in flight, we had a gunner in the right door behind a machine gun, and I was behind a machine gun in the left door. And anytime we made a landing out in the jungle, we were always susceptible to taking ground fire. And it was my job to protect my side of the aircraft. And so if we started to get shot at, it was my job to return the fire and try to suppress it so we could get out of the area. Every day we flew, when we got our missions in the morning, we really had no idea what we would be doing that day. We call them ash and trash missions. We might be flying combat assaults, taking in troops. We might be flying in food to resupply. We might even be flying in the mail. There were even times when I flew movie stars out into the jungle to do some USO spots.
Any names we'd recognize?
Well, yeah. Dale Robertson was one, and he actually fired my machine gun from the air. Yeah, that was pretty exciting for him. Nancy Sinatra. There were mechanical failures. Aerial flight is a dangerous job, inherently dangerous job. We had a saying that, if it isn't broken, just wait long enough and it's going to.
Your helicopter was shot down in October of 1967. Tell me what happened.
Well, we had, it's one of those ash and trash runs we called command and control, where we would take the commander of a ground element and we'd take them out and fly, supposed to be out of harm's way. We'd fly at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and that commander would be able to see his soldiers on the ground moving through an area. It was an area that was, it wasn't jungle. It was wide open plateau with bushes scattered all around it, and his soldiers had just fought a major battle and made a sweep across an area about a half mile square. And as we flew over, this young captain got the bright idea that he would gather some intelligence by stripping rucksacks off of North Vietnamese bodies that were lying on the ground. So he convinced my pilots to land the aircraft, and he also dragged me out of the aircraft with him to help him strip those bodies, which was absolutely terrifying for me because as much as I'm out of my element in this radio studio right now, I was definitely out of my element then because I was outside the aircraft. I was not a ground troop. But we successfully stripped off some rucksacks and got back in the helicopter and took off. It was uneventful, and I breathed a sigh of relief, and I thought, I survived that one. Then he saw some more, and he still wasn't done, so he talked my pilots into making a second landing. Well, the North Vietnamese had seen what we had done, and so they set out some soldiers that looked like bodies to act as bait, and they trapped us. Yeah, it was an ambush. So when we made our approach to land a second time, our skids didn't even hit the ground, and they had machine guns and rifles and all kinds of firepower hidden behind all those bushes. And it was all on my side of the helicopter for some reason. It just seemed like everybody in the world was shooting at us at once. The captain was killed outright. The pilots reacted immediately. With lightning reflexes, they pulled pitch and we flew out of there. As we were lifting off and the tail of the aircraft is raising up, a helicopter has kind of a unique profile when it takes off. And my left leg kicked up while I was firing away with my machine gun. And I remember thinking, that's odd. Why would that do that? And so once we were away from the area and I had time, we were at altitude, barely able to stay in the air. The aircraft was shaking very, very much. It was shaking real hard. I looked down, and there was a jagged hole coming up the top out of the top of my boot where a bullet had gone through the floor. Today, I still have the brass jacket of that bullet hanging on my Vietnam dog tags because one of the pilots came to the hospital later and found it in my seat and brought it to me as a small souvenir.
Did you think you were going to die?
I did. As we were starting to get out of the aircraft on that second landing, I saw the pilot out of my peripheral vision. I thought he had gotten back in the aircraft. In fact, he had taken three bullets in the chest. It had thrown him back into the aircraft. There was debris, all kinds of pieces of the aircraft were kind of flying in the air around me. And I just reacted instinctively. I just did what I was back there to do. It's just something you don't think about. And then, of course, later, as the adrenaline is burning off, that's probably when I was most terrified, was after I was already safe, because you think about what could have happened.
Did you come straight home after that?
No. Actually, they put me in the hospital for 5 days. Bandaged, cut my foot open, cleaned it out, sewed it back up, bandaged me up, and sent me back to my unit. I thought, this is great. I can wiggle my toes. I can walk after I heal up, and I'm going home. But the Army had a better idea, so they kept me in Vietnam, put me back down at the flight line. 3 weeks later, I was flying again. My foot still wrapped in a big white bandage. I had to wrap a green bandage around it because I thought that white one sticking out there made too big a target. I flew that way for about 2 more weeks before I was able to put a boot on. Later, as this was toward the end of my one-year tour, I found out that I would be afforded a free 30-day leave anywhere in the world if I extended my tour for 6 months. And Sydney, Australia looked pretty attractive, and so that's what I did. I actually wound up staying for almost a year and a half before I came home.
When you got home, you ended up signing up for the Iowa National Guard, and a lot of people who would have gone what you went through wouldn't have done that. Why did you decide you wanted to sign up for further duty?
I didn't realize it till later, of course, but it was actually my salvation, if you will. When I first got home, I went to work for Lennox in Marshalltown building furnaces, and knew absolutely nothing about PTSD or its symptoms. All I knew was that I just couldn't connect with anyone. It was almost like I was living in a foreign country. I worked from 3 to 11, and then I'd go drinking, and then I'd go back to work 3 to 11, and I'd go drinking again. I did that for 6 years. It was killing me. Purely by chance, I went to the National Dairy Cattle Congress in Waterloo in 1974, and I met a guy there that was doing recruiting duty for the Guard. He was standing at an Army helicopter, and when I got talking to him, coincidentally, he and I were stationed in Vietnam at Pleiku at the same time. And he's the one that told me about the full-time helicopter mechanic job that was available at the Waterloo Airport. So without a second thought, I went out and applied for it. I left Lennox 2 weeks later. And once I was back in that environment of Army aviation and helicopters and flight crews and the esprit de corps and the camaraderie and all those things that I had been missing for 6 years, were the answer for me. Then, of course, I stayed with that career for over 30 years, about 32 years, not realizing that 9/11 would come and I'd wind up getting deployed.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, the first deployment, we didn't leave the States. We went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and stayed there for a year. I was a first sergeant for a helicopter unit out of Boone. Yeah, I was 53 years old, and I was... I was something of but anyway, you know, most people in the active Army, by the time they're 38, they've got their 20 in and they're gone. And here I'm 53 years old on active duty. But we did our year at Fort Campbell. We fixed helicopters. We did a good job, earned a reputation, and came home. I think it speaks to the Iowa work ethic. We've kind of done that to ourselves since the Civil War. We do such a good job, they want us to come back. So 101 days later, my unit got activated again, and I was still the first sergeant, only this time there was a new commander on board, and he said, if my people are in Afghanistan and Iraq, then you people will be there too. And so during that second year, I wound up going to both Afghanistan and Iraq.
Steve, why did you decide you wanted to share your story as part of Telling Des Moines?
Well, my wife and I are both veterans. of the National Guard. She was the first military policewoman trained in the state of Iowa. We both were discussing about, you know, our careers, and I just feel it's important that our stories are preserved. I guess it goes, for me, it goes back to my dad. My dad served in World War II, was in the Navy for 4 years, 3.5 years on Guam. He never talked about it. He never shared his stories with us, other than we knew that he was in the Navy. When I started thinking about my own story, I actually sat down in January of this year, and I just finished my memoir. But I wrote it for my kids, and I don't even remember how I got involved with the telling project, other than back in January, someone had called me and asked if I wanted to audition. And I said, sure, why not? So I went to Ankeny and was interviewed for a couple hours. And then just a few weeks ago, I received another call and asked if I would participate. So here I am.
Have you learned anything about your own story by telling it?
It was difficult in the first. the other veterans in our project will tell you that during our first rehearsals, when I tried to get through my lines, the first act and the third act are pretty easy to get through. It's the second act when I tell that story that I just related about getting shot down. It's still difficult to get through. Because it's a signature moment in my life, but it's this production has been almost cathartic for me.
You started writing your story down for your kids, and of course, in this performance, the very first one coming up later today is going to be in front of a lot of kids. What do you want, especially young people, to understand about what you have experienced?
I guess I just want them to appreciate the sacrifice that a lot of us have made. I wasn't politically savvy when I first joined the Army. I was 18 years old. I didn't know anything. I was about as naive as you can be. We were trained to do a job. We were put in an environment that was sometimes purely in survival mode. But the entire time that I served for 36 years, the purpose for my service was to preserve our way of life, to defend this country. And that's painting a picture with a broad brush. But it's one that I feel is important. And, you know, whether a person goes into the military or not, or, you know, whether they do some other public service, it's just one more aspect of contributing to your country and to your fellow citizens.
Steve, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I mean, you're very welcome.
Steve Hyde served first in the Army and then later in the Army National Guard. His career running from 1965 to 2007, he served in Vietnam as a helicopter crew chief and door gunner, and is a recipient of the Purple Heart. He'll be telling his story as part of Telling Des Moines, with one performance today and then another one tomorrow evening and Saturday evening at 7 p.m. on the DMAC campus in Ankeny. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.